And welcome to Reliving My Youth. My name is Noel Fogelman. My guest this week is Steve Fawcett. Now, Steve is a founding member and original bassist of the band Heart. There for the first six albums with amazing songs as Crazy on You, Barracuda, Magic Man, Even It Up. All those amazing songs got the band inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2013, 30 years after Steve left the band. And we talked about just the awkwardness of the induction ceremony because they performed two songs. One of them was with the band that got inducted into the Hall of Fame, and the second song was with Heart's current band. So you can imagine just how awkward that part was. Steve is now in Heart by Heart with former Heart drummer Mike DeRozier and Steve's wife Summer, where they perform Heart songs the way they were meant to be. It is fantastic. They perform songs that Steve was part of the band, as well as songs that after Steve left, like Alone. And you know how on the show I always ask artists, they remember where they were the first time they heard one of their songs on the radio. This might be my favorite story yet. It is really, really funny. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Steve as much as I did. Do you have any plans to come to like New York and Connecticut?
Well, not specifically. I mean, we have plans to go everywhere, basically.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
And we'd love to go everywhere.
Or just say offers, right?
Yes, we're just waiting for offers. And, you know, I mean, and right now it's really challenging because, as you know, Heart is out doing an extensive touring. And they have this company, they're kind of big. What are they called? Oh, Live Nation.
Yeah, I may have heard of them. They're like the devil.
Yeah, so that, you know, they're, you know, into Heart and they're promoting Heart and they're doing all that kind of stuff, which is fine.
Right.
I mean, they deserve it. They, you know.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, Heart by Heart deserves it too, because we present the Heart music in our own way, which is totally valid. Totally
right.
Good, you know, and we're, you know, I have a lot of faith in our band, and I know I hate to toot our own horn, but I know that we're very, very good.
Yeah, toot away. I mean, the clips I've seen online. I mean, if I'm going to see, I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. I think Summer sings the songs better now than Ann does.
Well,
and not taking anything wrong with Ann, because Ann is one of the best singers of all time. But now, I'm going to see your band.
Yeah, Ann is definitely, she had the voice, the mental capability, the skills, the knowledge, and she, without a doubt, is one of the best female singers to ever exist in the rock world. And hand it to her. She's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because, I mean, I've seen clips now and they've, you know, they've kind of like, you know, changed some of the songs and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, making more medleys and, you know, this. And that's like, if I want to see like a particular song, my favorite, I want to see it authentic. I don't want to see them, you know, change it away. I have a term like Sting. Sting changes songs all the time. I call it, he's stingified, you know, like Every Breath You Take. You know, or stuff like that, because he changed the song 9 million times. I don't want to hear, you know, like my favorite songs, like 9 different versions of it. I just want to hear it how it was presented 20, 30 years ago.
That's our mission. When Mike and Summer and I first met and decided to do Heart by Heart seriously, that's one of the things we said to each other, is that we want to present the songs in a way that's going to create the nostalgia and love for the songs that people experienced when they first heard it, you know, 50 years ago or whatever.
How did it start?
Well, Mike and Roger Fisher and I were, we hadn't played the Heart material for a long time, and there was a party downtown in Seattle, and they wanted us to play a few Heart songs. So, and of course, it was Crazy on You, Magic Man Barracuda. And the person that was chosen to sing for that, you know, semi-reunion of the three of us was Summer. And so that was the first time I met Summer, and I was impressed by her skills and her, you know, acumen as a person and everything else. So we kind of became friends, and that was in February when we met. And then over the course of the rest of the spring, summer, and fall, we became closer friends. And then that friendship turned into a romance, and that romance turned into a duo. It was a bass and vocals duo. And of course we called it Heart by Heart because it's the two of us, Heart by Heart, together, you know, playing songs. And then we got some offers to play some bigger shows, and we thought, well, let's, instead of just being a duo, let's be a band. So we got we asked Mike DeRozier to do it, and he said fine. And then I don't know if you've ever heard of Randy Hansen.
Okay.
And he was a good friend of ours, and we had him be the guitar player, and we had a little combo, and it was really fun. And we, you know, started playing around Washington State, and then through our website, booking agents on around the America heard about us, and then all of a sudden now we started playing around East Coast and Midwest, and you know, just went from there.
Yeah. Was it ever hard to kind of win over the crowd?
Oh yeah. Yeah, very hard, because especially in the beginning, you know, people would come look at us like, let's see, is she gonna be able to sing this stuff or what? And then Summer starts singing, and they go, oh, no problem. And once they decide that the songs are being presented in a way that they can relate to, all that stuff just flies out the door, and they just start having fun. And that's what we experience all the time now.
Yeah, so everyone go on YouTube and check out, you know, Heart by Heart, because there are some amazing clips on there. And you even play like songs that you weren't a part of in the band, like Alone, which is, you know, it's a great song, and Summer knocks it out of the park too. What was it like, kind of difficult picking songs that you weren't a part of the band?
Well, not really, because we understand that, you know, being a band that's presenting the music of Heart, I mean, there's our era, which obviously and, you know, critically and everything is the most acclaimed version of Heart. But they were very successful, and they had some good, you know, songs in the 80s too. And those songs are fun to play. And to tell you the truth, when that band was out playing, they played the music of our era, so we're going to play the songs of their era.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah. Was there?
But yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the songs are fun to play, and there's a certain segment of our crowd that just goes wild with those songs, and they love to sing along, and they get all excited and dance and everything. And so we, you know, we have fun with it too.
Right. So I just want to tell you how we first discovered Heart. I was 10 years old. It was 1985. So I don't want to make you feel old or anything like that. Yeah. So it was obviously, you know, you were out of the band for a couple of years, and, you know, the self-titled album came out with the new band. And What About Love? It was the first single. Absolutely love. It's so, besides Crazy on You, my favorite Heart song. And I was in summer camp, sleepaway camp, and my counselor had a mixtape which had like Pink Floyd on it, Rush, and a song came on and it was like, wow, this sounds like Heart. And I never heard it before. So I go to the counselor and ask what it was. And it was Crazy on You. I'm like, wow, this is great. So we kind of, you know, bonded over Heart. And I just discovered like the first six albums. But before that, I'm like, this is amazing. And I just like went, and I was like 10 years old. Couldn't wait to get home to, you know, get the rest of the cassette tapes and albums. And that's how I became like a fan, not only of the 85 album, but the previous six. Well,
yes.
I shouldn't say a private edition, sorry, but the other ones were amazing.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Yeah, we were very lucky in the beginning. We had an excellent producer in Mike Flicker, and we, you know, and he imparted his knowledge to us. And of course, Mike Flicker and Howard Leese were partners at the time before we met them. And having Howard and Mike together, kind of teaching us the ropes and making sure that every recording and every second of every recording was perfect, really helped out in the beginning. And one of the things he would say in the studio, you know, constantly was, okay, you guys, I want you to play this good today because you're going to be listening to it for the rest of your life. And we went, okay, that'd be nice. And it was true. Now I listen to it to this day.
It's true. You really don't think about that, right? When you're recording, that this is going to be something that's there for everybody here, for every, like, once you record and send it out, it's not really your own anymore. It's everyone's in the world.
Yeah. And you hope that people like it and it has staying power, but we had no idea the depth of the staying power that was created by those songs.
Right. So how did first Anne and then Nancy get into the band?
Well, Raj and I had a couple of different versions of Heart back when we were living in the Seattle area. And you know how guys are, they they get disappointed and they and first thing they want to do is quit. And you know, and a lot of people, Raj and I were partners and we shook hands when we were 17 years old and we said, okay, we're gonna make a band. We're not quitting until we make it big time. And two people like that in a band can be super annoying to the other people in the band that maybe are not quite as ambitious, you know?
Right.
And so it was hard for us to get the other band members to be as enthusiastic as we were. So they quit. So it was just the two of us left. And when they quit, Roger and I had some debts and blah, blah, blah. We put an ad in the paper. We said, hey, we need a singer. We need another guitar player. We need a drummer. And so we put an ad in the paper and Ann Wilson was the one that answered the ad. And she had a friend that was a drummer and we kind of ran into a guitar player. And then they also had another friend that was a male lead singer. So we had a male lead singer, Ann Wilson, a drummer, a guitar player, Roger and myself. And we went out and we put together, a bunch of sets of cover material so we could play clubs. And we just started playing clubs in the Pacific Northwest area, Portland, Idaho, Washington State, of course. And then we got ourselves out of debt. And by that time, Anne had proved herself to be as ambitious, I say again,
right,
as Roger and I. And she had developed a relationship with Roger's older brother, Mike. And Roger's older brother, Mike, was living in Canada at the time, because he had went up there earlier to escape
the war,
the draft, basically.
Right.
So we kind of got together and we said, okay, we want to go to Canada because at the time the American economy was kind of in the dumps because of the war and people were unhappy with the war and there was all this, back and forth, about the war. But at the time the Canadian dollar was booming and it was one of the few times in history when the Canadian dollar was actually worth more than the American. So the band that we put together with Ann in the summer of 1971 kind of ran its course by December of 1971. We asked all the people in the band if they wanted to go to Canada and start anew, and they declined. So, but Roger, Ann, and myself, we emigrated to Canada. And we were accepted as landed immigrants. And when we got there, we set about forming a band in the lower British Columbia area. And we got a couple Canadian musicians. And before too long, we were one of the top acts in Vancouver. And we kind of had a really great reputation around Vancouver. And then we came to the attention of Mike Flicker and Mushroom Records. They offered us a demo. They liked the demo. They talk to the money people. Excuse me, I got something in the throat.
That's
I'm
okay.
sorry. And they said, okay, yeah, well, you know, we'll finance a record for them. And that was Dreamboat Annie. And the rest, they say, is history.
Yeah. Were most of the songs written already for Dreamboat Annie?
Well, it was kind of, when we did our demo, it was kind of cover songs.
Okay.
And, but we, you know, they said, well, we want you to do, you know, a record. And said, well, we can't do a record of covered songs. So we started, and we, you know, Hart and Roger and I, and we had always done our own songs, but we were mainly a cover band. So, but we start, you know, everybody kind of pooled all their knowledge and we came up with all these songs for Dreamboat Annie. Yeah.
I mean, to say like, you know, you knocked it out of the park on your first album is an understatement. I mean, with some of those amazing songs, I mean, right off the bat, Magic Man, Crazy Under You, and of course, you know, the title track, Dreamboat Annie. I mean, it's a hard act to follow.
Yeah. Yeah, and Magic Man was the very first song I recorded for Dreamboat Annie. And yeah, it's the first song on the album too. So it was really something else. And you know, like I said a couple minutes ago, I mean, Flicker did a great job. He really knew what he was doing. He knew how to arrange the songs to get the most sonic benefit out of where they were placed on the vinyl. That's why Magic Man opens up first side, because with that Moog solo in there, to get those low, rich notes, you had to have a lot of bandwidth. And there's not a lot of bandwidth when you get close to the inside. So you want as far out to the edges as you can get it.
Yeah, it's so like important. Like, I mean, I don't think it is anymore because people really don't listen to, you know, full length albums, but the track listing, the order of it is so important.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It takes you on a musical journey. And that's what albums were back in the day. I mean, we would, our favorite acts, we would go to the record store and we'd buy them and we'd get home and we'd unwrap it and we'd all imbibe in what we were ever going to imbibe in. We'd turn the lights down low and someone would set the needle on the record, and then we wouldn't speak until the whole thing was over. And then we talk about it, and we would, you know, and that was part of our philosophy, was understanding and realizing what it took to come up with parts that people wanted to hear over and over again. And, you know, and I don't know, there were so many different bands at the time and so many bands that were successful. And so many different, you know, kind of avenues of getting your record played. Nowadays, wow, I'm really sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
Nowadays, it seems like they have the same or very similar musicians playing all the parts on all the songs.
Right.
I mean, in every genre, too. So, I mean, I'm not putting it down. I think there's a ton of great music coming out today. I love it. I listen to it. But they do kind of narrowly define what is good, and they do it over and over and over again, which is fine. Which is fine. I'm not putting it down.
Right.
I never put down success. But and I love it too. I mean, I listen to it. I download music all the time that I like. So, and it's new music, old music. My favorite thing to download lately has been soundtracks, but
okay.
That's another story.
Right. Yeah. What kind of soundtracks? Because I feel like soundtracks now are kind of like dead, you know, like really? The heyday of soundtracks. I mean, I'm not like, not, you know, musical scores, but like actual, like, you know, ones from like the 70s and 80s where we're kind of like the heyday of like, you know, movie soundtracks.
Yeah. Usually the soundtracks that I like the best are the ones where they have a composer who composes music for that specific movie.
Right.
One of my favorite ones is The Mexican, you know, the one with
Brad Pitt
and
Julia Roberts. Yeah.
And then recently I watched The Gentleman. It's a Guy Ritchie TV show on Netflix, and the soundtrack for that is freaking amazing. It's kind of Carl Orff like in some ways, and it's got, you know, it's fun to listen to. And then I just like that kind of stuff. And then of course that led me back to, you know, the Marconi stuff, and then the who's the godfather of soundtracks would be, I can't think of his name right now, but he's, you know, super famous.
Yeah. I mean, there's like, you know, John Williams and like Hans Zimmer and, you know, those guys.
Yeah. I'm thinking even further back than that, the guy King Kong.
And, oh, wow. Okay.
And Treasures of the Sierra Madre. And I can't think of his name right now. I'm really sorry.
That's okay.
I could look it up for you.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. It's funny. You hold that up, and you know, this technology now where it's, you can basically stream any song. You can have your whole collection on your phone. What are your thoughts about like streaming? I mean, as being an artist, I mean, you get nothing, but people can access your music, you know, at the drop of a hat. So it's got to be a kind of a double-edged sword for like artists.
I love it. I love it because there's an entity. Have you ever heard of Sound Exchange?
Yeah.
So they keep track of downloads and streams and radio airplay. And you know, and then they send you a check every month. And, you know, for some reason, which I can't really pinpoint, but Heart is, you know, classic, not just Heart, but classic music from that era is one of the most popular streams and downloads and all that kind of stuff to this day. And we're very fortunate and happy that that's part of it. But, you know, it's well-deserved too. I mean, who doesn't want to hear, you know, Tom Petty, Led Zeppelin, right, you know, Pink Floyd, you know, Heart, Stones. I mean, that was the stuff that, you know, where the innovation happened every day. And there was, you know, and bands had a certain identity and they had certain musicians that had created their sound, and that sound, you can't reproduce it.
Max Steiner, the composer.
Max Steiner, that's the guy.
Yeah,
he did. How'd you come up with that?
But he also did Casablanca and stuff like that too.
Yes, yeah. I mean he was the guy that opened up the world of soundtracks, and we haven't looked back since. You know, there's the Newmans, all that kind of stuff, and it's beautiful music.
Yeah,
and it's not, you know, it's not like a symphony, like Beethoven's Fifth or anything like that, but they have little vignettes that express so much in, you know, 30 seconds.
Yeah. And it'd be hard to watch some of these movies without music.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now, yeah. So how did like opening up a for Rod Stewart and Faces in Montreal come about?
Well, we were, it's a good story to that. We were playing a club in Calgary, Alberta. And I just, so Ann and Nancy were on Kelly Clarkson yesterday and they told the story.
Okay.
And we did not get along with the club owner, and the club owner thought we were rubbish. You guys are rubbish. So we played Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Thursday night, he came to us and said, you know what? It's just not working out, you guys. I'm going to have to let you go. I got another band for the weekend. And so we were like, what? So, because we'd never been fired ever. So we were kind of like, and that's just when Mike and Howard had just joined the band at that point. And they looked at us like, what the hell, you guys? You just get us in your band and then we get fired. And So we go kind of go home with our tail between our legs, or not home, but back to the hotel. So we're all kind of at the hotel giving each other side eyes and everything, like, what the hell is happening, you know? And we get a call, and it was the record company saying, hey, is there any way you guys can get out of the plane this weekend? We said, well, as a matter of fact, and they said, good, because you're going to open up for Rod Stewart and the Faces in Montreal and Toronto. So we want you to pack everything up, and we're going to put you on a train tomorrow morning. You're going to go across Canada on the Scenic Cruiser, which
Right.
was an awesome experience. I mean, I'd highly suggest it. It's very, very nice. And we happen to have some nice weather and everything, so it was really beautiful. We get to Montreal, you know, and we sleep overnight. We get up in the morning, and Howard, Mike, and I go out and we have crepes.
As you do in Montreal.
Yeah. And, you know, we went shopping. I went shopping at a thrift type store with clothing. And that's where I bought that famous green vest, you know, the one that's kind of like a bustier from
Yeah.
that. And I still have it to this day. And it's, people have, there's been a lot of comments about that vest over
Right.
the years. And so we played the show that night, and you know, we didn't know what to expect really, because we had no idea how much airplay Heart was getting around the country and all that kind of stuff. And this was just in Canada, right? Because we had that Canadian content thing going.
Right.
And the one thing about those pesky radio waves is they don't stop at the border. They don't know that there's a border, so
Right.
they keep going right into America.
I went to college up in Buffalo, so I discovered a ton of, Canadian music that way, which was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we do our sound check for the show, and we're all excited and everything, and we get on stage, and I say, ladies and gentlemen, Heart, and there's kind of a, polite applause. So we play Magic Man, and the place went, that was our first song, and the place went nuts. And it was like, you know, it's 15, 18,000. It was their hockey arena, right?
Right.
And I looked out, and everybody had their lighters on. You remember that?
Yep.
Lighters and applause and clapping. And I looked out and I went, okay, that's it.
We're here.
We've made it.
Yep.
This is it. And the rest of the show was really well received, and a couple of days later we opened up for them in Toronto too. Same experience. So we knew something was going on, and we were all happy about it.
Did that boost the sales of Dream One Addy?
Oh yeah,
Yeah.
oh yeah. It certainly did, and that was. But at the time, it was just released in Canada.
Okay.
But very, you know, soon after that, we made arrangements for it to be or released in America. And so during that year, we kind of did. We opened up for some, you know, other acts like ZZ Top
Okay.
and the Bee Gees, and not quite as huge as, you know, Rod Stewart was at the time, but still really fun and interesting. And so after Christmas, we kind of talked to our accountants and everything. Says, well, we love Canada. We kind of want to stay here. And they said, well, that's fine. You can stay in Canada, but you're going to be paying income tax for Canada and America.
Right.
So, but if you go to America, you just have to pay American taxes. So we said,
Bye-bye.
I vote we go back to America.
Yeah.
So we got back to America. And by March, we had released Dreamboat Annie in America, and we started, you know, touring. And, you know, we opened up for every act you can think of that was popular back in 1976. And we did, you know, Ken Kinnear, our manager at the time, he did a great job of getting us in front of the maximum amount of people. And then wherever we went, the record company, it was kind of a fly-by-night record company. Not that it was bad, but
Right.
it didn't have the network that, like, say, CBS Records or the big record companies had.
Yeah.
So they would look at our schedule and they go, okay, we better get some albums in St. Louis because they're going to play St. Louis pretty soon. So they would figure out a way to get the albums there. And then and it kept working, you know, then we'd sell a bunch. And then finally they got Kmart. Remember Kmart?
Oh, yeah, very well.
And once you got Kmart, I mean, Kmart had stores everywhere.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and they bought like truckloads of records. And all of a sudden it went from gold to platinum to double platinum, you know, just really quickly. And then we all just went high five.
Yeah.
On our way. So it was really fun.
Right. Now the cover of Dreamboat Annie, it's very, you know, beautiful cover, but it just has the sisters on it. Were you guys kind of like annoyed about that?
I would say, let me think. Yes. But we had no choice because we, you know, we did the album and everybody was okay. And we had no idea what was going on with the cover. And then all of a sudden, one day we were at the studio doing something and they came, hey, here's the cover. It's like, what?
Right.
And, but the, I guess the record company had, they felt that they needed to emphasize the girls. They thought that was a great way to go. And you know, you opened up the record and there was all kinds of pictures of the guys in there. So,
yeah. Which, I mean, like, I kind of miss those days. I mean, I know vinyl is kind of back now, but just the liner notes, the pictures, see who worked on, you know, the production of the album. You don't get that now with streaming.
No.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and what I found too is that you even have a hard time figuring out who wrote the songs because, I mean, they used to list that on, in albums.
Right.
Who wrote this, who played this,
exactly.
You know, what day it was recorded, everything, all that information was there. Nowadays, it's like you have to, you know,
really research it.
Yeah,
absolutely. I guess the unofficial, I mean, I don't know how you would classify Magazine, which I really, really enjoy. There's some great songs on there, but there was a lot of headaches with that production, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Cause so what, like I was saying back in 76, when we were out touring, so they'd send us out for 2-3 weeks, you know, and we drag ourselves around all over the place. And we were in a van at the time and sometimes a bus and sometimes an airplane, but it was tiring. And then they say, okay, you got a week off, you know? So they'd send us, we go back home to Vancouver at the time. And we, you know, sit back and get some sleep. And then we get a call, hey, you're booked at the studio tomorrow, 9 a.m., blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, what? And that's how Magazine was recorded. So that's where we did Magazine and Heartless, Devil's Delight, all those songs that came about in between the tours of promoting Dreamboat Annie. So we were doing that, and then at the time we had recorded some live radio broadcasts from one of our favorite clubs down here in Seattle, and then we started having issues with Mushroom Records because they were kind of patronizing to us, you know, instead of, you know, because the record contract says, okay, you sell so many records in this amount of time, and then so much later, they were supposed to hand over the funds, and they said, well, don't worry about the funds. Whatever you need, we'll take care of it. Kind of like Colonel Parker type attitude,
right?
And we said, no, we're not doing it. So all that year, 1976, from March until December. You know, so we ended up touring America, Canada, and then we ended up in Europe in December. Every member of the band, even though we had a double platinum Dreamboat Annie, we were all making $200 a week.
Wow.
Because we didn't want to accept their, you know, we didn't want to say, because they were saying, well, how much money do you need? We'll just write you a check.
Right.
We'd say, well, What we need is for you to do the accounting and give us the what the accounting says we're due. And it was, you know, just went on and on and on. And so what ended up happening was we that kind of gave us a loophole to get out of the Mushroom Records thing. And by that time, the big record companies that we'd been after in the beginning came and they said, "Oh, well, gosh, I guess you
Right.
So they kind of there was kind of a bidding war for us, and we ended up, you know, going with Columbia Records, which a division of that was Portrait, and that's where Little Queen came out on. But in the meantime, Mushroom Records, unbeknownst to us, mixed and put out magazine.
Nice.
Well, when we saw that, we went, "Hey, well, what's going on?"
Yeah.
We didn't approve that.
Right.
So back and forth, and we ended up cutting a deal with them where we would mix and you know, pretty up all the songs, you know, the way we want them presented, and they can re-release, but only after we do Little Queen.
Okay.
After we release Little Queen. But so that's what happened.
Right.
So technically, Magazine was album number two,
Yeah.
but legally it ended up being number three.
Right. Yeah. Either way, I mean it's I mean the
I
title
know.
card, yeah.
I love Magazine.
Magazine,
I
such a
love
great
that.
song. Yeah.
I love that album, and I love all the playing. Because what happened was, okay, Dreamboat Annie was kind of like, okay, we'd bring in Howard here for this, and then we had different drummers besides Mike play on different songs.
Right.
That was before Mike actually officially joined the band. But Magazine was the one where we had all been playing together for, you know, touring and all that kind of stuff. So we had a feel for each other, and that's where Magazine,
Right.
Heartless, Devil Delight, that
Yeah.
where that stuff came from.
Right. And this song gets covered so much, Bad Fingers Without You, and it's your version's great. It's like, and does such an amazing job, and she knocks it out of the park with that version.
Yeah, we knew what we were doing.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Now, like, how important is that? 'Cause they always say you have like your whole life to record your first album and then, 6 months to do your second one. But you guys were on tour and you mentioned were like a well-oiled machine. So how important is that being on tour before, and performing these songs before you actually go out and record like your follow-up album?
Yeah, it is important, and because you develop a rapport with the rest of the musicians in the band, and just by playing together and having that intimate contact, you know what who does what and what to expect from this musician, and how to fit your parts all in together so they make sense, and you know, because ensemble playing is not just five people just playing whatever they want. It's everybody kind of agreeing, but not, you know, not saying you play this and you play
Right.
that. Well, it's everybody kind of understanding what their role is and playing, you know, what fits with this and what fits with that. And me being a bass player, you know, I'm okay, think of it this way. Okay, so I'm working with a great drummer,
Right.
two great guitar players, Howard Leese and Roger Fisher, another great guitar player, and Nancy Wilson, and then Ann Wilson, and you don't want to step on any of them, but you do want to make up a part that's interesting and fun to play and fits what's going on. So I had a big challenge, and you know, through my youth, I had really delved into what role a bass player can play in either adding to the song or being playing in a way that is distracting, that takes away from the song. So I didn't want to be a distraction, but I wanted to be a positive influence on everything, and I think I achieved that.
Yeah, I totally agree. How did you know when to do that? When to contribute?
Well, it was something that I just learned, and understood from the very beginning because, okay, one of my biggest influences when I first started playing was, of course, Paul McCartney.
Right.
And he had a way of playing very interesting parts, but they didn't distract from the song. They added to it. And then another one of my big influences was Bill Wyman.
Okay.
And he was very stoic in his presentation, but he ended up playing some incredibly, compelling bass parts. And then, of course, John Paul Jones came along, and it's like, holy moly, why couldn't I have been born in England?
Exactly. Now I want to jump ahead, I guess, a couple albums. Maybe LeStrange, which I guess is the fifth album, and Even It Up is like one of my favorite songs. Just the like that point, was everything just kind of like, autopilot for you guys?
Well, I not really, not really. I mean, you try everything you do, you try to put, your soul into, especially at that time. And so with Even It Up, Anne decided she wanted to be like Paul McCartney and play too. So she ended up playing the bass on that one. But I'd been playing it the bass for all the demos and live performances that we did. I mean, she kind of, but whatever. I mean, she did a great job, so.
I mean, how, like, was there a lot of like kind of like politicking in the band during those days? Was it hard?
Yeah, that's as soon as Raj left the band, the politicking kind of started being showing its its head. And the ladies, they understood that if they wrote a song with us in the room, there's a chance we could go, hey, I came up
Yeah,
with,
you get credit.
and they might go, and they might have to share. And that was, some people have a hard time sharing.
It's kind of funny how like in the mid 80s on, they didn't write any of those songs that were so successful.
Exactly. Yeah, they want, part of the deal with signing with Capitol was that they wanted them to work with some, songwriters. And Anna Nancy touched on that yesterday, and there was a bevy of songwriters that were popular at the time and that everybody was choosing songs from, and they got on that bandwagon, which is fine. I mean, success is success. And Howard and were basically the driving forces of the music, in my opinion, for that era. So
So you and Mike left after Private Audition. Did you guys leave on your own? Were you forced out? And what happened with that album?
we were asked to leave, and we were happy to leave at the time because the politics of the band were, it was just,
Too much.
just had to roll your eyes and just go, what the, why do people act like this? And I'm not saying that we were perfect, but with Private Audition, Mike and I were we wanted the band to take up a rock, more rock attitude, some the kind of stuff that people were had come to expect from Heart. And we wanted to, because there are, the songs we did on Dream About Annie, like Magic Man, Crazy on You, were come see songs. Oh, I want to see him play that one live. And of course, on Little Queen, it was the same thing. Barracuda being the big one, so. And we kind of want to continue that field, but Ann and Nancy wanted to take it in a different direction. And they were both fairly distracted by life, as they say.
Right. Okay. Was that the last time you saw them before you got inducted into the Hall of Fame decades later?
Well, no, Ann and I were, especially in the early days, were fairly good until she met Mike Fisher. We were fairly good friends, and
Right.
we talked and hung out and joked and
Yeah.
had fun and whatever. We weren't, I wouldn't call in anything close to romantic, but we were good friends.
Right.
And I'm sure she respected me and I respected her, and we had a good relationship. But then once people get into a relationship, it's hard. You can't really have friends with, especially in the beginning, with the opposite sex, basically. So
Yeah.
we still appreciated it and liked each other, but she was busy being a girlfriend, partner with someone else.
Now, tell me about how you found out about the Hall of Fame. I mean, because that was 2013, I remember, right? And I guess it was like 30 years after leaving the band. So just tell me how you found out about it.
Okay, so we were actually nominated the year before in
Right.
2012. And I hadn't heard, I really hadn't thought about it too much. Because I just thought there's no way that Hart's going to get, in there. Because the Hall of Fame didn't even exist when we first started.
Right.
Didn't even exist. So I was in a relationship with Summer at the time, and she had a day job. So I dropped her off at work. I was driving, and she had an apartment, and I was going back to my house. And I was driving down the road, and on came owner of the Lonely Heart.
Okay.
And Alan White lived in Seattle, and he was a good friend of ours. And Alan was, he he could see how Summer and I felt about each other, and he kept saying, "Don't let this one go, Steve. She's pretty cool. Don't, all this kind of stuff." And course, I followed his advice.
Right.
But so I was driving home, and I was pulling up to the stoplight at kind of a busy intersection, and Owner of the Lonely Heart came on, and then the DJ says, "Speaking of Heart, Heart was nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame today." And I went, "What? The what? Why?" And I didn't know what that meant at the
Right.
time, a nomination. So I just about drove off the road. I mean, I swear to God, it was dangerous. And oh, I got to put the brake on to stop now, all this kind of stuff. So it was kind of weird. But so I got home and I started getting phone calls, and I made some phone calls, and you kind of figure out what, oh, it's just nomination. It's not,
Right.
you're not in, it's
Yeah.
nomination. You go through a whole vetting process after that. And that whole year I was on pins and needles. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't, everything was Rock Hall of Fame,
Yeah.
Rock Hall of Fame. And we weren't not nominated to go to be an inductee that year. So that was kind of disappointing, but I thought, it was an honor to be nominated.
Right.
That's a step in the right direction. So we were not chosen to be inducted that year. And so we went on, and then they announced the 2013 inductees, and we were amongst that class. And I went, "Okay, that's good." And I just let it go. I just said,
Right.
"If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, there's nothing I can do about it." And so I just kind of forgot about it. And unlike the previous year when I was totally focused on that, the whole time, this year I was just living my life just the way I live it, and just
Right.
going on with life. So I was downstairs, fooling around with my bass and my amp, and I was in my dorky, how it is when you're home and you wear your dorky, comfortable clothes
Of
and all that.
course. Yeah.
So I was just down there, shuffling around, all that stuff. And I got a phone call, and it was somebody from the Hall of Fame. They said, "Well, you're in." I said, "In what?"
Right.
"Oh, you're going to be inducted this year into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame." And I went, and I couldn't talk. I couldn't
Right.
talk. I was, and I was very pleased and excited to be chosen, and once and then once you get chosen, then all this process starts of understanding what being chosen meant. So I didn't understand that they were just choosing the original band from the 70s to be inducted.
Yeah.
Because the other, the 80s version had some success.
Right.
They continued the legacy, but for some reason, the Rock and Roll fame didn't care about that band so much. Maybe they will in the future, who knows? So we just went about our lives and figured out, okay, April 18th, we're going to
Yeah.
Los Angeles. We're going to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And then all these politics
Course.
stuff
Yeah.
goes on. That's like, oh my God. So, and then because you don't know, well, are we going to play, or are
Right.
they going to let us on stage, or what,
Yeah.
But it worked out. So they called us all up on stage, and we were allowed to play, but we were only allowed to play
One
"Here's
song.
Me on You."
Yep.
We couldn't play "Barracuda," and which is kind of odd because Roger Fisher, original guitar player,
Yeah.
Mike DeRosier, original drummer, are co-writers of "Barracuda."
Right.
Why wouldn't they want the co-writers of "Barracuda" to play on "Barracuda" for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on
Yeah.
one of the biggest nights in Hart's history, period?
Right.
But so they had their
Yeah.
version of Hart, and here's another sidebar to that. Over the course of since Mike and I left the group, there's been 60 different musicians that have cycled in and out of the
Right.
called themselves Hart in the meantime. And we're going like, boy, oh boy,
Yeah.
it's a lot of musicians.
Yeah. And like the current version who was on there weren't even in the 80s, mid-80s band, right?
No.
Yeah.
And so here's a little sidebar. Dave Grohl, he inducted Rush.
Right.
And we just got through playing, and Mike was backstage, and he was with Dave. And they were kind of, "Oh, way to go, sounded really good, blah, blah, blah."
Yeah.
And then Hart started Barracuda, and Dave Grohl, who, of course, is drummer,
Yeah.
he goes, "It's slow. It's slow. What are they doing? It's too slow." And Mike thought the same thing and said the same thing. And they looked at each other like, "Oh, what's going on here?" And it was kind of, a semi-disaster, but I
Yeah.
guess there's some people that think it's good. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean it's difficult. You're inducting the 70s version. Have the 70s version perform all the songs. That's the band that
Yeah.
is there,
Yeah,
but
and Cantrell was there with us, and
yeah.
McGriddy and
There's Cornell.
Cornell, that's right.
Yeah.
And for some reason they wanted them on stage, and it's like, well, because I
Why?
was talking during rehearsals, I was talking with Cantrell,
Yeah.
and he goes, "I don't even know why I'm here. I mean, what I'm playing doesn't even, I mean, it d doesn't
Yeah.
matter. I mean, you guys have it down."
Yeah.
But it was fun. Jerry's a great guy, and he's fun to hang out with. So, but it was, we had a, he stood on my side of the stage, so we had a nice
That's
rapport.
good.
It was
Right.
fun. He's a good guy.
Good. Good. Was there any like communication between you and the sisters during the whole thing?
Well, not a lot, during the rehearsal the day before, of course, that's the first time we'd actually seen them for in a long time. It was cordial, but not anything other than that. And it was kind of weird. But the very first time we played Greasy on You together, it should have been recorded because it was absolutely perfect. It was like riding a bike. We all just got up there. Okay, next.
Yeah.
You know.
Was there ever like a thought in like your mind, maybe Mike's mind, Roger's, that this could, go somewhere after the induction ceremony?
Well, we wanted it to, because it was a great opportunity to capitalize on the, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame version
Right.
of art. And the no takers on that in that camp.
Right. I guess you probably saw the writing on the wall when you guys couldn't do Barracuda, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Was there anyone that night, like, because obviously there's so many, amazing musicians and celebrities there that you basically had to meet?
Well, we, in the early days, like when I was telling you about 1976, well, one of the bands that let us open up for them was Rush. And we opened up for them in Detroit and St. Louis, and which was very, very nice of them to let us allow us to do that for them, and it helped, helped us along in our careers. So so we had that connection with Rush, and of course, and Rush was Canadian, and we at the time we were Canadian too, and we had that, we both had that connection, and I don't know, it was really nice to catch up with Alex and Getty and say hi again and be be inducted together. It's a they're great people to have in our class with us.
Yeah, totally. They're I love them too. They're such a great band.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, do you remember where you were the first time you heard one of your songs on the radio?
I know exactly where I was. Would you like to hear the story?
I would love to.
Ann and Nancy both said their story yesterday, and they were
okay
driving, and they heard it on the car radio.
Right.
But so we were playing a club in Vancouver, British Columbia, Starvin' Marvin's. And we were told before the night was over that the next day a certain radio station in Vancouver was going to play Magic Man. And I thought to myself, okay, I've been playing my bass since I was 15 years old. Never heard myself on the radio. I want to hear myself on the radio for the very first time.
Right.
So I made special note of this radio station and all that kind of stuff. So I get up in the morning, turn on the radio, and I heard every band that was popular in the day you could think of. Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, Stones, Beatles, Doobie Brothers, everybody, every band you can think of. No Heart. So I thought to myself, well, did I get the wrong radio station? What's the matter here? And I said, well, maybe they meant tomorrow or some other day. So I'm looking at the clock and I'm going, I got to get ready, because we were playing in the club that night. So I, of course you want to take a shower, whatever. So I turn the radio up, go back, turn on the shower, jump in with one ear, listening for the radio. As soon as I get wet from head to toe, bam, it's on the radio. So I didn't even turn the water off. I just jumped out of the bathtub, didn't even grab a towel. I ran down the hallway, water flying everywhere, stood in the middle of the living room, turned the radio up even more, and listened to myself for the very first time, soaking naked and soaking wet, dripping water all over the place.
Right.
But I got goosebumps then, and I'm having goosebumps right now thinking about it.
Wow, that's great.
And of course, Magic Man, it's not a short song.
Yeah.
Not a 2-minute 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
It's got guitar solos. It's got Moog solos. It's got, you know.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it was. I loved it. I loved it.
Right.
It's a great, and I'll never forget it. So it's a great way to. That's it. First time I heard myself on the radio.
Yeah, that's great. I always ask my guests that question. I think that's probably a top three response. That's awesome. Yeah. So Heart by Heart, website's heartbyheartby.com. You got a show coming up next week, right?
Yes, in Millville, New Jersey. Is that
Okay.
right? Is that right?
I think so. Yeah, that's kind
Yeah,
of
because
the Levoy Theater, I think.
oh, Levoy, we call it
Yeah.
Levoy.
Levoy. Okay.
But yeah, I mean, and we've had great communication with the theater, and they sound like they're really excited about us coming, and we're excited about going there. And it's kind of an unusual thing to have a show on a Thursday night, but that's what happens. So,
Right. Yeah. Well, hopefully you'll get some offers for New York and Connecticut down the road because I'd love to
yes,
see you guys. And but Steve, this was fantastic. Best of luck with everything going forward, and hopefully I'll see you soon.
thank you, Noel. Appreciate you talking.
And a special thanks to Steve for joining me today. Go check out their website, heartbyheart.com. They're amazing. Go on YouTube and check out some of the clips. If you can't see them in concert, they're really, really good. And if you have a guest suggestion, you can hit me up on X, formerly Twitter, at the first Noel 19, or like the page, We're Living My Youth on Facebook. You can go to iTunes, check out all the past episodes we've had. While you're there, please rate and review the show. I would really appreciate it. If you don't have iTunes, not a problem. Shows on SoundCloud, Spotify, Podbean, Amazon Music, YouTube, basically wherever you can find a podcast. And we're really coming close to our 7th anniversary show. I have a really special guest for that. Stay safe, everybody. We'll see you then.